Once you know, you're stuck with it. A kid can be traumatized for the rest of his life by some startling sight or sound at the earliest age. 4-year-old Bert Swenson watched his father dancing in a stuffed dress and silk stockings, and from then on thought his father was his mother because she always wore pantsuits. That impression lasted forever, although Bert only saw it once, at the King's Highway Men's Club charity show. Sid Polansky, aged 5, vacationing at his Uncle Jake's in the Adirondacks, happened to be trotting up the farmhouse staircase when his Aunt Christina came flying down, naked to her panties, her cannonball breasts with nipples like shooting gallery targets, bouncing as she screamed that a snake was in the bathtub. Unable to deal with such an experience a second time was the reason the Polanskis gave for Sidney's reluctance to have anything to do with women. These examples may seem extreme, but they are certainly plausible in terms of the effect they had. There are other more sobering events, many of which are capable of imprinting an ineradicable perception on the brain of the child. When the Dust Bowl had wiped out its last farm and the shattered mom-and-pop stores began to open up again, selling Tootsie Rolls and the like, and small factories on the verge of bankruptcy started doing a little business, the working stiffs drifted back, the economy took a deep breath, and energy began to flow. It provided the impetus for men like Jack Dorfman to start up the machinery and hire the help to run it. Everybody was out to make a buck. Dorfman, a chesty man in his 50s, active and vigorous, limited his cigar smoking, but never exercised. In his opinion, that was for people who had nothing else to do, or the idle. When he arose, he did perform a few knee bends in his underwear, but that was mainly to get rid of gas. He walked a few blocks to the elevated at a rapid pace and felt fine as he sat on the hard rattan train seats of the Brighton Beach line to read his morning newspaper, glancing at the tight-skirted behinds of the young office girls as they entered the train at the various stations. His wife remained safely at home in their brick and stucco house in Flatbush with their daughters and young son. At work, Dorfman's blonde, meaty secretary, Miss Mayer, in her mid-30s, adored him. He was out selling most of the day, though he did work on the books occasional evenings, with Miss Mayer at his side. Sometimes I had a bite at the diner on the corner afterwards. Dorfman was seldom in the factory. That was run by his partner. But he knew all the employees by name. At noon on Saturdays, the workers filed by Miss Mayer's desk, where she handed out the weekly pay envelopes, arranged alphabetically in a shoebox. Once in a while, Dorfman brought his boy with him and let him hand out the envelopes. Jeremy got a big kick out of doing it. He was 12, skinny, wore glasses, and was working on a scheme to entice the girl next door to wrestle with him, uncertain why the need to do this obsessed him. He came to recognize the employees, though unaware they regarded him distrustfully or disdainfully, and some enviously, as the boss's son, humiliated at receiving their pay packets from just a kid. They shuffled by with wan smiles and a glum thanks when he handed them their wages. He'd heard his father discussing problems at the factory with his mother, but had paid little attention to the details, more interested in peeping through his bedroom window at his future wrestling partner as she prepared to retire. On one of those nights, while donning his pajamas, he heard his father's bellicose voice declaiming from the parlor downstairs. They won't do it. Not to me, they won't, he shouted.
Jack, you got to be careful. Don't jump to conclusions, she implored him.
There was a minute or two of silence as Jeremy tiptoed from his bedroom and listened for the conversation to resume, sitting at the top of the stairs. His father's voice turned to an indistinct growl, then rose again.
They think I don't know who's behind the whole thing, his father declared.
You know?
His mother asked worriedly.
Of course I know. That shrimp, that good-for-nothing, your Rabinowitz friend. But I'll get him. I'll get that skunk.
Well, how can you know for sure? She demanded.
Never mind how. I found out, and I'm the one putting the bread on his table. That skunk.
You'll fire him? She gasped, alarmed.
Any minute, once I get the goods on him.
You can't fire Rabinowitz. He has 5 children to feed.
Are you crazy? Just watch me. He's a communist.
He's not a communist. He's a socialist.
You just gave him away. Now I know he's a communist. Yes, he's the leader. He's the one trying to get them all to join the union. Half of them have already signed up.
Jeremy yawned. He was very tired. He flopped into bed and dreamed about his father, dressed as an undertaker, firing on a Rabinowitz in the shape of a skunk. But Rabinowitz scrambled away, followed by his family, 5 little skunks, the smallest skunk crying, "Papa, Papa," but in skunk language. The next day, Saturday, when Jeremy awoke, the house was strangely quiet. His father had departed for the factory. His sisters, usually up and about and making a racket, he found in the breakfast room with his mother sitting at the round table and looking everywhere but at each other. The table, loaded with breakfast cereals, milk, bowls, rolls, and cream cheese, remained untouched. He stared at his family blankly.
Go look outside, you dope, his youngest sister said to him.
He kept staring at their taut faces for another moment, then turned and ran to the front door. He gazed through its glass panel. On the sidewalk bordering their small patch of lawn, 2 men walked slowly up and down before the house, bearing professionally painted signs in large, bloody letters, the signs nailed to long sticks. He recognized one of them, Bennett, a thin man wearing a battered hat. He was a sweeper and packer from the factory. The other man was a stranger, in a torn pullover, baggy pants, with a cap pulled down over his eyebrows. Bennett's sign read, Dorfman and Company on strike. We demand a union. The stranger's sign, more ominous, struck Jeremy like a blow to the heart. It read, Dorfman's workers lose fingers on cutting machines. Dorfman pays starvation wages. His jaw hung open. Jeremy stared at the funereal pacing of the 2 shabby figures as they trod the exact dimensions of the house frontage and back again without pause. The neighborhood had closed its windows and drawn its shades as if to shut out the disgrace, or perhaps in sympathy with their assaulted neighbors. Jeremy, pale, silent, and ashamed, withdrew to his room.